Okay, so Zachary is off doing some space road trip. Not exactly sure. So this week, we are joined by the inimical Chance Miller. Hello, Chance.
Hey, Mayo. How's it going?
It's going good. It's been a few months since you were last on Happy Hour.
Yeah, February, I think.
Yeah, and you were a fan favorite last time, I will say.
Oh, was I? I guess I got to live up to that again.
I got a comment saying, that Chance guy is really good. Obviously, if you don't know who Chance is, he writes on 9 to 5 Mac as well, and he does a daily podcast called 9 to 5 Mac Daily, which is like daily news rounds up. Obviously, you should listen to that and subscribe to that if you don't. So, do that. But, of course, it's happy hour. We got stuff to talk about. Firstly, I want to discuss the... So, this came out like last week, kind of in the middle of the last beta drop, like beta 4. And last week, we talked about Safari changes in the beta and stuff. But this kind of went by the wayside. And essentially, Apple is announced that it's going to deprecate a whole bunch of SiriKit commands. So if you go all the way back to the start, iOS 10 was the first time that Apple added like a third-party integration or opportunity for apps, right? So Siri existed since 2012, but it was only Apple's services, only Apple's domains. And when you say a domain, you mean like calendars or to-do lists or payments or like media, like some kind of, you know, category of things that you can talk to Siri about. And then obviously over time, Apple added its own additional domains, they added sports scores and stuff. But it wasn't until iOS 10 that there was actually an opportunity for third-party apps to do it. And with iOS 10, what they did is they added the SiriKit framework. And what the SiriKit framework allowed apps to do is basically register for domains. And it wasn't like a free-for-all. So the way like Amazon Alexa works, the way that third-party like skills, the way they work is that basically the developer just gets the audio. Well, they get the transcript of the audio that you speak to the speaker, right? So if you say a command and it includes the name of the app in it, the third-party app basically gets the text and it can do whatever it wants with the text, right? The way that SiriKit was designed was that Apple handles the actual like text parsing, which was quite clever, actually. So like for calendars, if you were a third-party app who would declare support for the calendaring domain, Apple would listen to your ingest all the commands through Siri. They would list it out for ones that included references to the name of your app, like Fantastical or whatever. And then they would pass the request to kind of meet the templates of what Siri can understand. So like, add a new event, what's on the calendar, what's happening on this day, et cetera, et cetera. But it would be up to Apple to actually do that kind of semantic analysis of the text and basically work out the action that the user's trying to perform. And then the app would only receive, okay, we need you to provide this data for this action. And by segmenting out like that, it meant that Apple could, over time, change the activation phrases that would go to the same, that would route to the same command. As the language models improved, every app would get in automatically, and every third-party calendaring app that integrated with Siri would always work the same way. It wasn't like you had to remember a specific syntax for Fantastico and another syntax for a different calendar app. They would essentially all work the same. Obviously, you're in the limits of what Siri can understand, which is, you know, a complicated question. But the idea and the concept of the framework was quite clever. Apple would handle the actual like text analysis. The app would just provide the data, and that would be it. The limitation of that approach compared to something like the Amazon way is obviously it only works with the domains that Apple releases, right? And when SiriKit launched in iOS 10, you could do like and messaging and to-do lists and calendars, but it was only about 6 domains in total. And over time, you know, in iOS 11, iOS 12, they added a few more. Most recently, the biggest one they added was for media, right? So apps like Spotify and Pandora and stuff could just talk to Siri. You can ask them to play music using the media intents. But what happened last week is Apple basically just said, well, you know, about a third of the intents that we added over the years, yeah, we're just not going to support them anymore. So they drop support for appending to a note, creating a task list, and deleting a task, right? So that's in the kind of like listen notes domains. And it is kind of weird because they still support adding a task, but they've now dropped support for deleting a task, which is a bit odd, right? And then the other stuff they deprecated was like payments. So back when iOS 10 was like a thing, Apple made a big deal that like you'd be able to do like PayPal payments through Siri. That was around the time that they released Apple Pay Cash, right? So to try and be fair, they offered the same opportunity to third-party apps. So you could like pay bills or transfer money, do like banking through Siri. That was the idea. There's also stuff like photo search. And in CarPlay, there were all these intents for like all these potentially different things you could do to your car, like changing the audio output, changing the climate settings, changing the seat settings, changing the radio station. All that stuff has basically been deprecated as of iOS 15. And if a customer has an app that uses those intents on iOS 15, Siri will just say, "I don't understand you. I can't perform this action." So basically, they just don't work anymore. Kind of out of the blue.
So is the idea that you should use shortcuts for this stuff now? Is that what they want?
Well, it's kind of unclear, right? Because there's no like direct replacement. And although these intents were doing no harm just being there, I guess they were underused. Like, because they're not deprecating the entire intent system. They're just deprecating this, like, you know, 25 total different commands. And maybe they didn't really give an explanation for why they're ending support. I would hope that they're doing like a back end upgrade to like the Siri models or something, and they're basically streamlining. Okay, well, Siri supports, you know, 100 different commands are in the world of calendaring, but we know that 99.99% of people only do like adding an event, right? And so by taking out all these other commands that are very rarely used, it basically reduces the search base for Siri to understand you. So the idea is you're going to get a higher rate of accuracy for the commands that people actually do use, right? And that comes at the expense of all this stuff going away. And I think, frankly, some of these intents were not adopted by many apps, and they weren't used by many customers, even if the app supported them. Because one of the big ones was getting ride booking, right? And that was part of iOS 10 launch as well. When Uber and Lyft were like launch partners, Apple had press releases saying like, "Hey, now you can use Siri to book a ride and everything." And like Uber launched that feature back in 2010, which was what, like 2015, but it only lasted like 2 years. And then they just removed it from the app and didn't support it anymore. So like, yes, ride booking is now officially gone from the system, but you practically probably didn't use it anyway because none of the big services would support it anymore. So, and then in the modern era, like shortcuts kind of patch over some of this, because in iOS 10, the only way that you could have Siri integrations was through these intents. Right? But when they added the shortcut system in like iOS 12 and iOS 13, well, now you basically can make Siri do whatever you want because you can set up your own actions, right? And you can, any developer can make pretty much any shortcut that can do pretty much anything, including show UI in the Siri like transcript and, you know, work in the background and play music and do all this stuff. But it's not quite it's not really the same kind of thing. Like because shortcuts, the way shortcuts work through Siri is you basically say the name of the shortcut to do it, right? So, yeah. You'd say like, I don't know, if Uber did support, you know, like a ride booking shortcut, you could say like, book a car with Uber, and it looks for that like exact name match in the shortcuts app. And then the Uber app can ask you follow-up questions about where you want to go and stuff. But it's nowhere near the flexibility of like the actual Siri kit system, where you could say the same command in like 30 different ways. You didn't have to get like the exact pronunciation right. You didn't have to get the exact syntax right. You didn't have to like register the shortcuts up front. If you had the app installed, Siri would just have this intelligence there and you could use it. So it's kind of a disappointment in that regard. And like, you'd hope, at least, intuitively, you'd hope that Siri would get better and better over time, being able to do more and more things. And here we are, and they've just culled like a big swath of functionality. Yeah. Even stuff that's not like regularly used. It's not stuff that like nobody used, especially like, you know, appending to a note or creating a new task list. Like, if you're a big like to-do list user, you're probably deleting tasks from Siri and you won't be able to do it anymore. Like, I don't know what you think about the whole like Siri situation and shortcuts, but shortcuts are great for what they are and they let you like automate things, but they don't really they're no match for like an actual, you know, Siri kit understanding you. Like, that's the difference, right? When you do a shortcut through Siri, it's like, okay, it just matches the text and it's just doing what you set up to do. Whereas the actual Siri kit stuff, you know, was way closer to like the machine understanding your intent and your context and your, you know, you could say the same thing in 20 different ways and you get what was going on.
And if these features weren't really being used as SiriKit intents, you can't expect people are probably going to go to the shortcuts app and make that shortcut and remember the syntax every time. So shortcuts aren't really a replacement.
Yeah, and setting up shortcuts is not, you know, straightforward. Like, with the beauty of this system was if you downloaded the Uber app, the next time you use Siri, you could just ask to book a ride and it would say, do you want to book a ride Uber? And then you go and you could do it and it would have, like, you know, the multi-step process with different questions, different prompts. And it would also be localized for every language. That was the other thing, because the SiriKit system, because the actual, like, destination app only got, like, the action, the abstracted action, they didn't have to worry about passing the actual language. You know, Apple could add languages over time and the apps wouldn't have to update or do anything at all, because all of that analysis was already happening, you know, at a higher level than what they would receive, right? So the shortcut system, it's kind of like a workaround. I wouldn't call it a replacement. And that's the bit that's kind of more sad to me, is that, you know, you want Siri to get better and better and better. And although I think that them cutting down some of the stuff that's less used might be a way for them to optimize some of the stuff, especially now they're doing, like, what, like, offline Siri and things like that.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like we're really going in the right direction. Like, because offline Siri in iOS 15, you know, it's great that it exists, but it's very primitive. Like, you couldn't rely on using Siri offline. It could basically open apps and change system settings and play and pause music. But, like, you don't feel like you're talking to Siri. You feel like you're talking to, like, a very stripped down version that maybe answers you slightly faster but can barely do half the things. Like, I haven't tested this on the latest betas, but at least on beta one, you could say, like, when you were offline with Siri, you could say, like, music play or music pause. But if you said, like, play a playlist, it would be like, you need internet to do this action. Like, the actual understanding of the offline Siri is very primitive and basic.
Like Siri of the iPhone 4S days, basically.
Or even worse, right? Like,
yeah, even worse.
I think
worse.
Voice can, like, because before there was Siri, there was voice control, right? Which was, like, the actual thing. And that, you could do, like, all sorts of commands, because that was more like a shortcut system, right? It was, like, built in by the system and basically provided by Apple. But it was, like, you use these exact words in this exact order, and you could do all this stuff. The offline Siri in iOS 15 is nowhere like that. It's, like, you can literally toggle Bluetooth. You can toggle airplane mode, which is quite funny, because you can go offline and online when talking to Siri. And you can set timers. And that's about it. Like, it doesn't feel like we really still had, like, a generational leap with Siri that everybody kind of wants. And all of their devices now rely on Siri more and more and more. Like, and later this year, they're going to add, they're going to let third-party accessories, you know, relay Siri commands, which is kind of a nice thing. So, like, your Ecobee could take Siri input and get you an answer. But the way it does that is it relays through a HomePod that's in the house. Mm-hmm. So it's not like expanding Siri to third-party devices, really. It's more just like a remote speaker and microphone setup,
right?
Which, I mean, it's still a nice feature, but it's nothing like revolutionary. And you look at you know, what the Google Assistant or the Amazon ecosystems do, and they put Siri on Sonos speakers, they put Siri on everything, right? And it can be standalone. And in many ways, their systems are much more intelligent and their third-party ecosystem is much broader. Like, Apple invested in the SiriKit idea, and I think it was a good idea, but they didn't back it up enough. Like, they didn't expand the number of domains very much. Like, they did it a bit, but not enough, right? And they didn't improve on Siri's understanding. And fast forward a few years, and now they're just stripping it down and taking stuff away, which is kind of, you know, kind of a disappointment. Like, I just, in 2021, I'd kind of hope the status of Siri would be a bit further along than it actually is. Like, do you actually use Siri for much day to day?
No, hardly at all day to day. I mean, like you said, though, maybe this is paving the way for, like, iOS 16 Siri's 10 times as fast, but in the interim, it certainly looks bad.
Yeah, and it's not like they've announced, because when they did, like, the Maps, you know, Maps 2.0, they were like, look, we understand there's a situation with Maps. We're working on this brand new system from the ground up. We're literally doing you a new map that's with Apple-controlled data in all these, you know, different 10 different ways. But with Siri, there's kind of radio silence. Like, an offline Siri is the only thing where it's felt like it's actually, you know, somewhat different to what was there before, but it's such a small leap. And it's not like the promise of offline Siri. You could do basically anything, any command that doesn't require an internet connection to, like, find the answer. You feel like you could be able to ask Siri offline, right? But that's not what it is in iOS 15. It's basically, you know, play or pause, change system settings, and start and stop timers. And yeah, a lot of people use Siri for timers, so I guess it's optimizing for a very common use case. But if you actually want to use Siri offline, you'd be sorely disappointed by what's there in 15.0. Happy Hour this week is brought to you by ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN is a simple and reliable way to make sure that your network traffic is secure wherever you are without notable impacts on your internet speed. Public Wi-Fi security measures are always under attack, with unscrupulous actors looking to steal your sensitive private information wherever and however they can. Take back your privacy with ExpressVPN. Internet privacy and security is critical. You have to be aware of the entire realm of online hacking, the entire legitimate internet filled with trackers and ads with analytics embedded, all of them following you around the web, and even your ISP may be watching your browsing history and selling it on to advertisers. Using the internet without ExpressVPN is like taking a call on a bus on a speakerphone for everybody to hear. You don't want to be that person in public, so don't be that person online. Sign up today at expressvpn.com/happyhour. Internet service providers know every single website that you visit, and time again, they've been found to sell on that data to ad companies and tech giants, who then use that data to target you. ExpressVPN creates a secure, encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet, so people can't peep on your online activity. ExpressVPN secures and anonymizes your internet browsing by encrypting your data and hiding your public IP address so nobody can see what you're doing. To enable ExpressVPN, it just takes one click. Download the app, click to connect, and instantly 100% of your network data is secure. ExpressVPN is rated the number one VPN by CNET, Wired, and The Verge, and you can install the app on iPhone, Mac, and even install ExpressVPN directly on your router so everybody who shares your Wi-Fi can be protected. I've used ExpressVPN, and it really is so effortless to use. You just click one button, and you can get on with what you're doing, in the knowledge that all of your internet traffic is protected. And you can even use it to get around geographic content blocks on pesky websites that just won't let you see what's there because of where you live. ExpressVPN is really fast, so you can stream high-quality video over the VPN with no buffering, especially as we're all traveling around more again now. ExpressVPN, whilst you're out and about, is so useful. And if you're in the European Union like me, there's still so many websites that just put up a content blocker wall because of GDPR. Like, and the VPN comes in real good handy. It's kind of crazy how many websites still just block out so much of the world because of privacy laws. Secure your online activity by visiting expressvpn.com/happyhour today. That's expressvpn.com/happyhour. And you can get extra 3 months for free. One more time. expressvpn.com/happyhour. Okay, so also this week, this wasn't like publicly announced by Apple, but people found that in the iOS 15 beta, on beta 4, that their photos were actually getting processed differently, and specifically a lens flare was being automatically removed. Now, this isn't like the artistic lens flare when you get like, you know, the big reflections, but I think you've probably seen this because I see this all the time on photos you take. The little like green dots, almost like the tiny little like specks of like sharp bright light that happens when you're like taking a picture on iPhone outside. And I don't know if you'd agree with me here, but I feel like that has gotten worse over the years. Like,
no,
I
don't know if,
as they like, I swear 5 years ago, 6 years ago, that never happened. And then maybe around the time when they went to like the dual camera systems, I feel like around that, like iPhone XS, that kind of time frame. You suddenly, you know, any picture you take outside, you don't have to be aware of like the two little dots that are, you know, 30 degrees off in your on screen, causing like these big like green dots of bright color, just kind of ruining the picture. So it seems like iOS 15 beta 4 uses like machine learning algorithms to basically remove them. But yeah, you
I know this is like a question I get from my family and friends. They'll be like, is something wrong with my camera? There's green dots in all of my pictures. So it's kind of wild that it took him this long to do this and that it's just kind of like quietly there in beta 4 with like no announcement.
And it doesn't seem like a complicated thing, right? Because it's not really any different from like a clone tool in like, you know, Pixmare where it's just a circle and you press the button and it just, you know, takes the background and replaces it with the foreground color. And like, I almost feel like this shouldn't be a problem in hardware, but maybe the advancements in making the sensors bigger and stuff made this more symptomatic. And that was like the trade-off, like to get better pictures. It just made the lens
so are the sensors
more likely.
Supposed to get bigger this year with the iPhone 13? I think they are, right?
Yeah, for sure. Like, especially on the Pro Max, I think it's like a 20% increase on all lenses.
So maybe it was so bad on the 13 that they had to figure out how to fix it in software.
Yeah, because frankly, it was borderline probably one of the worst parts of the entire camera system on the iPhone 11, the iPhone 11 mm-hmm. Pro, which I have. And I've heard it's worse on the iPhone 12. So like,
in terms of the lens,
so yeah, like that is kind of rough. But you're probably right, actually, that they were like testing the iPhone 13. It's like, what are these dots doing over here? It's like, the picture's really nice, but there's a big green dot in the way. So the fact that they've actually just fixed it in software, I mean, great. Mm-hmm. Like, they didn't keep it just for the iPhone 13, at least. Like, it just seems like it's going to be available to everybody. And it doesn't seem like a very, you know, sophisticated fix. It's just like an automatic, like, background content replacement. So why was it not done sooner, I think, is a very fair question. Mm-hmm. Like, the two things that annoy me about the iPhone camera system is lens flare and night mode turning on when you don't want it to. Like, that annoys me so much. If it's like you're in the dark, but it's not like pitch black. And you mm-hmm. say if you're in like a disco setting, right? You want to take a picture, but the people that you're taking a picture of, it's not a setting where they're going to be still, right?
Right.
And quite a lot of time when you're like dancing or whatever, it's dark. People are rushing around like crazy. No one's staying still. And what's the iPhone do? It automatically enables night mode, which expects the frame to be essentially a static shot. So
you got to stop moving for 5 seconds.
Yeah. In the pre-night mode days, the camera would be the photo that would be taken, the flash would go on, right? It'd be a bit dim, mm-hmm. but everything would be sharp, right? You'd have the grain or whatever because it's a dark environment, but you could actually see the people. If you do that with automatic night mode, everyone's just a blur because everybody's moving around and it's trying to do the thing where it takes a longer exposure and shooks it down. And there are toggles like to stop night mode from enabling themselves automatically, and you know, you can go into like settings and make it so that night mode doesn't turn on automatically and you have to turn it on manually every single time. But the problem there is like, that's an option, but I don't want it off most of the time. It does it right. It's just in these specific circumstances where it's really annoying. And the way to disable it is not like, oh, you just flick this button inside the camera app. You have to like dive into like four menus inside settings to actually stop it from turning itself back on again. Because if you just turn it off like temporarily in the camera, you know, you like, oh, you click on night mode, then you drag that slide all the way to the left or off.
Mm-hmm.
If you like, oh, 10 minutes later, you want to take another picture of what's going on at the party or whatever, well, night mode's automatically back on again.
Yeah.
So like, to actually physically disable it permanently, you have to go like four menus into settings. So then you have to like do it every single time you're having like a nighttime party. And I'm sure most like normal people have no clue that the setting even exists to disable it. So they probably like, well, I just never use my iPhone at night anymore. Or they just take selfies, which don't really have the same problem. Like, I think that's, honestly, I think that's what people do. They just take selfies because the selfie camera doesn't enable night mode.
Or they use Snapchat. So many people take all of their pictures in Snapchat just because there's no interface. You just tap the button and it takes the picture.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, everybody's pictures are so bad because they took them in Snapchat because they don't know how to, like, turn off night mode and actually change their iPhone's camera settings.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. Yeah, like, the iPhone takes great pictures in the daytime, but the nighttime situation doesn't quite, like, how often are you actually taking pictures of, you know, like landscapes and stuff? Like sometimes, mm-hmm. obviously, and it's nice for that situation. But the automatic night mode, I feel like it needs like a machine learning detection for there's like 10 people in front of you and they're not standing still. So don't use the night mode part, you know? Also this week, this is very interesting. The Apple Store went down for like a few hours. And this happens, right, obviously it happens around product events and keynotes and stuff, but it also happens periodically for just maintenance and they do who knows what while the store's offline. But this week, they actually did something noticeable. So they added back the store tab to the website. So around like at the time that Angela Ahrens like joined Apple, it was probably around 2015, mm-hmm. they got rid of like the separate store and the Apple website was also just like the store website. So you'd have the tabs across the top, they had the product tabs, and then on each product page, you could go to like the store part and buy it. And they've basically reverted it. So now there's like a new storefront. So now if you go to apple.com, the very first tab is just a tab called store. And it basically gives you like, it almost gives you what's on the front page of like the Apple Store app, just like, mm-hmm. those like cards of information. So you've got like the promotion for the university student discount when you can buy a Mac or an iPad and you get AirPods. They've got like the collections of like MagSafe accessories. They're obviously advertising the iPhone 12 and the iMac and stuff. And then you've got quick access to Apple support. And if you scroll even more down, there's just like, you know, literally just products that you can buy in one click. I don't think it's really interesting. They basically, you know, flip-flop for across a 5-year span of basically going back to what they had before. I always found the integrate experience a bit confusing if you did actually just want to buy something. Like, if you wanted to browse the website, then I guess the old design was better. But if you were like going on the website to like, okay, I actually want to buy a charger, I guess you could search for it. But if you just wanted to like browse the catalog, you're kind of lost in the old way. Like, try and find buy an AirTag before the store tab showed up.
Yeah,
you know, like
that's what I was just about to say.
Yeah. So where was it hidden before? It's under like iPhone, right?
iPhone, yeah.
Yeah, it's like the last option inside the iPhone. Whereas now it's like, okay, I want to buy an AirTag, click store. And then at the very top of the page, they've got Mac, iPhone, iPad, Apple Watch, AirPods, AirTag, Apple TV, HomePod Mini, and accessories. So right there, you can just click AirTag and buy. And I think this partly reflects like, you know, a change in fashion or a change in leadership, but also it just reflects the fact that Apple's product line continues to grow, right?
Like, yeah.
Even back in 2015, their lineup of products was a lot smaller, both in terms of like the active things they sold, in terms of, you know, like they didn't sell a HomePod or HomePod Mini or AirPods or like an AirTag and stuff. But even just in the product lines themselves, there were less options sold for every model, right? So I think at some point now they've got so many products again that they kind of have to separate out and offer just like, you know, a simple store tab. And of course, all the other, and I expect they'll probably have more changes, right? Because now that they have the store tab, they can probably repurpose some of the Mac, iPad, and iPhone tabs to like have less bits in them, right? Because right now it's like a lot of stuff's like duplicated, but over time I'm sure they can now like streamline the other stuff to be more about like the actual products, and then the store tab can take on more of the shopping responsibilities again.
Yeah, this is much better.
Yeah, because one thing you don't hear Tim Cook say anymore is that all our products sit on one table. Remember that was like his go-to phrase for so many years of his run as CEO. And in the last like 2 or 3 years, he's basically stopped saying that because I don't think it's really true anymore. They just have so many SKUs and so many different products, and not necessarily to the point of excess, right? Like I think most of the stuff is perfectly fine. And once the MacBook Pros get revised, please soon,
maybe.
Once they get revised, I feel like the entire product line is pretty hard to like discredit. Like there's not much on the on the page that feels like a bad buy or like really old or stuff. Like I guess they still sell, like, you know, like the Intel iMacs are still sold, but you have to like really look for them, you know. Like you're buying an M1 iMac, you're like loving life, right? As soon as they rev the MacBook Pro, it's hard to find a product that's like, yeah, don't buy that, you know what I mean? Like you could basically tell someone to buy whatever they want and they're gonna get like something that's new and modern and fresh,
which is kind of like the go-to recommendation. You won't have to say, buy the 13-inch MacBook Pro, but the one with 2 ports, not the one with 4 ports. You can just say, buy a MacBook Pro, whichever one you want.
Yeah, definitely. Happy Hour this week is also sponsored by Charge ASAP. 9to5 Mac has teamed up with Charge ASAP to give away Apple's latest generation MacBook Pro to celebrate the launch of the company's new Flash Pro Plus portable charger. The new Charge ASAP Flash Pro Plus portable charger aims to be the ultimate all-in-one charger that you can take with you. With a 25,000 mAh battery capacity, with enough power and ports to charge all of your devices. That obviously includes charging your iPhone and your Apple Watch wirelessly at the same time. The primary Qi charger is a magnetic pad, and it can charge at up to 15 watt speeds compared to the typical like 5 watt, you know, standard Qi chargers that you find around the place. And the Apple Watch charger is rated for 5 watts, and you can charge both your iPhone and your Apple Watch at full speed at the same time. And in addition, on this portable charger, you find 3 USB-C ports and 1 USB-A port. One of the USB-C ports offers up to 100 watt power delivery. That means you can charge a 16-inch MacBook Pro at full speed. And the other USB-C ports provide 20 watt and 60 watt power delivery, more than enough for the rest of your power-hungry devices like iPads and stuff. The Flash Pro Plus even features an integrated OLED screen. Yeah, the charger, the portable charger, has a screen on it. It tells you all about what's going on with your charger, including like the unit's temperature, battery percentage, current wattage, what's charging, etc. Like, it sounds kind of funny, but I think this is really nice, actually, because a lot of portable chargers you see around the place, they just have like 4 little LED dots that are like, okay, well, I guess you either got 25, 50, 75, or full charge, right? They try and convey a lot of information with 4 blinking dots. And it's just a lot nicer to have an actual OLED screen right there to just read off the information. So you can get a special pre-order deal on the Flash Pro Plus portable charger for a limited time. Just follow the link that we've put in the show notes. And don't forget to enter the giveaway for the MacBook Pro as well. That link is also in the show notes. Thanks to Charge ASAP for sponsoring the show. So last week, that rumor popped up from Mark Gurman that Apple is preparing to launch the Apple Pay Later stuff, right? So basically a buy now, pay later scheme, but integrated directly into the iOS user interface. So basically anything that you buy with Apple Pay, you'd be able to get financing for, right? So a big expansion of like the Apple Card program, which applies to, you know, Apple products. They're working on a way to roll that out to basically anything you buy with Apple Pay, you'd be able to buy on financing. But they're not quite ready to announce that. But what they did announce this week is that they're partnering with a third-party company called Affirm, which is one of the big like buy now, pay later companies in the space, to basically offer monthly financing in Canada. So the Apple Card is US only, right? So this is like their equivalent of offering Apple Card monthly installments, but in Canada?
Yeah, that's what it seems like.
Yeah.
But in Canada, it's only going to be for the iPhone, the iPad, and the Mac. Because in the US with the Apple Card, anything you buy from Apple pretty much can be financed.
Yeah, I think you can buy an AirTag on finance if you want. Pay like $5 a month or whatever. Yeah, but I mean, with the Apple Card as well, it started iPhone only, right? And then it took them a while to roll out everything else. So maybe they'll do this in Canada too. Apple said that the program will be interest-free for a limited time. So I guess take advantage of the offer while you can, and then it'll go up to like standard rates. Because the Apple Card is like, Apple Card monthly installments is 0% financing, right? It's you only pay interest when the time's up. Whereas it sounds like this is like right now, promotionally, it's interest-free. But in Canada, it's going to actually have the standard interest. So you're basically just buying something over 12 or 24 months with a loan, essentially. Like you're not even getting like a 24-month 0%.
I've used Affirm for like my Peloton.
Mm-hmm.
So Affirm and Peloton have like a special agreement where almost every Peloton finance program is 0%, but I know that it varies a lot by credit score. But that's not the case like with the Apple Card, where if you have an Apple Card, you have a credit limit on that Apple Card, but then you can finance anything from Apple with 0% as long as you stay under that credit limit.
Right. But I guess you obviously have to get credit approval in the first place for the credit limit. Mm-hmm. So giving interest back. Whereas if you're buying through like Peloton, they don't have a pre-existing relationship with you, right? So
yeah. Like a firm you have.
When the actual Apple Pay Later thing rolls out, that'll require like, you know, approval and everything, and you'll get rejected if you have a decent like, credit or whatever. Because a firm's like quite big, right?
A firm's huge. They're like, I know in the United States, they're probably the biggest one. And then the Bloomberg report said that the actual company powering the new program in Canada is called Paybright.
Which is
a Canada-based company that a firm acquired like last year, I think. So,
right.
Okay. A firm's big. They're probably the biggest player in this space.
Yeah, then a firm's who Apple's going to be competing with when they do actually roll out Apple Pay later. But in the meantime, I guess, you know, partner now and compete later, I guess is the motto. It's interesting though, because like Apple had so many financing programs around the world before the Apple Card came out, and then it kind of seemed like they were just going to consolidate everything with Goldman Sachs, because like in the UK they stopped Barclays with like a huge offer of 0% financing, and they stopped offering that, and it was kind of like in the name of, oh well, you know, the Apple Card's going to roll it internationally, and then all those benefits would just be serviced through Goldman Sachs, right, as the merchant bank behind that thing.
But
here they are being like, well, we're partnering with Paybright on this thing in Canada. So feels like they've had stumbling blocks, like launching the Apple Card in more countries or something. Like maybe that was the original plan, and now they've had to like backpedal slightly.
Because we're coming up on 2 years of Apple Card, and we haven't gotten anything in terms of an international expansion.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to go to Apple Pay Cash, that's like 5 years, and it's still US only. And what did they do with the Apple Card this week? They like added some offers or something as well?
Yeah, they're rolling out special offers from partners. So like in addition to the cash back promotions you get from like Apple and Panera Bread, select partners are also offering exclusive perks for Apple Card users. So one of the first ones was free Apple News Plus from Apple, and like a free month of the Panera Bread unlimited coffee subscription or something.
I see.
So It's kind of like traditional credit cards.
Ads in your wallet app.
Oh, yeah. Here we go again.
Yeah. I mean, that's a lot of cards. Like, I guess a lot of credit cards offer like those kind of benefits.
Though, yeah. Right? It's one area where Apple Card has always kind of been behind, but they say it's because you don't have to pay fees with the Apple Card. Like, there's no annual fee, but mm-hmm. now it looks like there's no annual fee, but you might get some perks here and there.
Yeah, like trials, basically. You don't like anything.
Yeah.
Crazy. I mean, I guess you take it if you want it. But the only problem with that is that unless it's like a really good offer, it kind of like devalues the premium experience, the Apple Card, a bit, because you're getting like slight advertising every time you open the wallet app, you know? Like, yeah, you are getting free stuff, but you're also having to like see the ads. And like, unless it's something that's really good for free, like, I guess if like a month of free coffee or whatever, that's like decent, you know? Like, even if it's not your like coffee shop of choice, it's a month of free coffee, right? The Apple News thing is like, well, they just kind of gave it away, you know? That's more like the side of advertising, and depends what else they do, obviously. But I think the Apple Card had like positioned itself as more of like a premium option, and then just slapping like these kind of offers on the top, which are like pseudo ads, it kind of devalues it slightly, in my opinion. But people want it, though. That's the problem. People want to, like, when they do like credit card comparisons, they want to say, oh, this one comes with like retailer offers, right? And this one doesn't. Mm-hmm. So maybe I'm more inclined to buy the retailer one. So
it'll only get bad if they start sending you push notifications for them from the wallet app, but we're not there yet.
Yeah, because right now it's just like a little like panel in the app, right?
Yeah, it's just like a little banner. Closing.
Yeah. You see, if you've got a notification saying get free coffee for a month, then it's more invasive and out of line. One kind of cool thing that Apple started selling this week, they started selling the Magic Keyboard with Touch ID separately. So this was first debuted in the M1 iMac, right? And for the M1 iMac, it is color matched for the color of the iMac. But this one, it's a different shade of silver than the silver you get with the M1 iMac. But it's basically the same design. You've got the rounded edges, like they've got thicker corner radius on like the escape key and the globe key. And in the top right, you've got the little Touch ID button, so you can unlock your Mac that way. But it only works with M1 machines, correct?
Correct, yes.
Yeah. And you have a... What machine do you use at the moment?
A 24-inch iMac.
Okay, so you actually have...
Yeah.
And I assume you've got the version with the keyboard, right?
Yeah, I got the extended keyboard.
Oh, you got
in
the
blue,
one with the number
unlike Zach.
As well.
Yeah.
Because I think they charge, what, $200 upgrade on the base iMac to get the... Because the base M1 iMac doesn't come with the Touch ID keyboard, right?
Right.
You have to get the second one, which I think is a $200 upgrade.
Yeah, it's from $1,300 to $1,500, I think.
And for that, you get the Touch ID keyboard and you get two extra ports. You get the extra USB-C ports on the back. Well, Apple's... If you want, you can buy the keyboard now standalone for $149. It's an option.
And something to consider is, like, even if you don't have an M1 Mac right now, you might still want to get the Touch ID one just in case your next Apple Silicon Mac, like you buy the new Apple Silicon MacBook Pros in the fall or something. Because they are selling a version of this new redesigned keyboard without Touch ID.
Which is basically the same keyboard apart from the edges are curved, right?
Yes, right. Yeah.
And the, actually, a big point, it now comes with a braided USB-C cable. So if you want a nicer cable, now you can get one. Like, I love Magic Keyboards. I use them. Like, I have an external Magic Keyboard from a couple of years ago. But they are kind of expensive.
Yeah.
Like, the $149 Touch ID keyboard should probably be like $99, but a lot of Apple's accessories like that are just slightly too overpriced enough that you can complain about it, but not so overpriced that I guess you still buy them anyway, because here I am with one. But I do like the feel of them and stuff, and I like having the layout and the feel of my external keyboard matching my laptop's keyboard. So
yeah,
I have to use the external keyboard full time now with my 2016 MacBook Pro, because my Butterfly keyboard is in dire straits. But I still, even though I sometimes do try and type on it, and it's just nice having like the same shape of the keys and, you know, the right positioning. And the only thing I would say is that this keyboard, like, it still has the because this was the same on the M1 IMAX, right? But the arrow keys are not T-shaped.
On the extended one, they are, though, aren't they?
On the extended one, I think they are. Yeah, but on the compact one...
On the compact one, yeah.
It's the up and the down arrow are half height.
Right.
But if you go to, like, the laptop, so, like, a 13-inch MacBook Pro nowadays, that's, like... That's not an extended size, right? Because it's the numpad on the side. So it's the same like width as this one, but the arrow keys are T-shaped, which is a bit strange. Like specifically for this keyboard, they've definitely like pushed harder on the stags, I think, because of that to match up the corner edge and stuff. And it does look nicer to not have like the bumpiness in the bottom row, but I do feel like you lose some little bit of that consistency of having the exact same keyboard style across both, but Apple makes choices.
Yeah.
Sometimes kind of hard to understand.
There's also the new Magic keyboard or Magic trackpad that you can buy separately that also matches the corners perfectly and also comes with a braided lightning cable.
And like if Touch ID had a future, they'd probably like have like a Touch ID button on the Magic trackpad somewhere as well.
But yeah,
I think this is all just stopgap. And there was that report from Mark Gurman that we talked about on Apple last week, which is basically that Apple intends to ship Face ID and everything they sell in the next over the next couple of years. Like Touch ID is only here because of price reasons. It's not here because they actually like it.
Yeah.
Which is fine by me. On the iPhone, I think there's more of an argument that having both Touch ID and Face ID makes sense. On the Mac, like you're sitting down at your computer, you're looking at it, Face ID standalone is going to be fine. And I would pick Face ID over Touch ID every time.
On the iMac, I find myself not even using the Touch ID very often, just because Apple Watch Unlock is pretty good for most things nowadays. So,
yeah,
Face ID is definitely the way to go in the future, hopefully.
Yeah, like Apple Watch Unlock is like, it's not like 100%, but it's close enough that having an actual button, Apple Watch Unlock is reliable enough that you don't reach for the Touch ID button. Do you know what I mean? Like, I have Touch ID on my 2016 MacBook Pro keyboard, right? Because it was, like, the first one to put it on. But I'm not mentally trained to push my finger over to unlock it. I'm just trained to sit down and my Apple Watch does it. And it's, like, the 1 in 10 times where it doesn't work, it's like, oh, great, now I've got to put my finger over here. Like, what are we living in the future? No, this is so laborious. I've got to move my finger. but I wouldn't probably rush out to... I wouldn't upgrade my Magic keyboard just to put a Touch ID button on it because I'm wearing the Apple Watch all the time and it gets it right most of the time. Like having the Apple Watch on your wrist is almost like having Face ID on the laptop, just with an ankle bracelet.
It's one way of looking at it.
Yeah, not quite the best analogy. Happy Hour this week is also brought to you by She's Birdie. Whether you're walking around your neighborhood, going for a walk in the woods, running errands, or whatever else, you just want to feel safe. And with the Birdie, you can keep doing what you love to do with added peace of mind. Birdie is a simple, sleek, personal safety alarm. It's designed to be easy to carry and simple to use. Carry it in your purse, in your pocket, or maybe in a bag on a keychain. If you do get into a situation where you're worried, it just takes one quick pull to activate the Birdie. It will sound the alarm, which emits a loud 130 decibel siren, and it also turns on a flashing strobe light to help deter any attack. And unlike something like pepper spray, the Birdie is no danger to you, which means you can feel confident to activate it without worry. Now Zach isn't here this week, but he's had one of these things. He spoke about it on the show before, how like small and compact it is. It comes in nice colors. It's just a nice thing to carry around with you. So if you do get into the worst situation, you have some thing as a deterrent. And Birdie goes wherever you do. The compact alarm comes in multiple colors and a brass keychain, so it can be easily attached with your keys or attached to a bag. Over 300,000 Birdie alarms have been sold to date, with thousands of 5-star reviews. Join the flock today for a saver tomorrow. And right now, She's Birdie is offering Happy Hour listeners 50% off their first purchase when you go to shesbirdie.com/happyhour. Go to shesbirdie, that's spelled shesbirdie.com/happyhour for 50% off your first purchase. Once again, that's shesbirdie.com/happyhour. Okay, let's talk about this iCloud stuff.
All right.
So this is basically multifaceted, right? Because there's like three different parts to it. I know you had a briefing over this. Do you want to kind of like bullet point the things and then we can kind of discuss them in turn?
Yeah. So the first part of the announcement was new features for messages. So now when a child, all of these features are designed to protect children, Apple says. So the iMessage feature is when a child receives a sexually explicit image, the image will be blurred and then the messages app will display a warning that says it might be sensitive. Then from there, you can tap view or hit I don't want to view this photo. But if you tap view, the parent organizer of the iCloud family will get an alert. So that's like the message, the broad strokes of the messages thing. The more controversial thing is what Apple's calling CSAM detection, and CSAM refers to child sexual abuse material. And this is basically how Apple plans to look at photos that are stored in iCloud photos to see if they match photos that are stored in a database of child abuse photos. And then third, Apple has new features for Siri and search. So when you ask Siri how to report child sexual abuse material or child exploitation, Siri can help you file a report with the appropriate authorities. And then when someone goes to perform a search that could be for child abuse material, they'll see new results that say this is harmful and problematic.
Right. So the Siri search stuff, it's just like you know, links and resources when you're talking about similar subjects. Like, perfectly fine. It's just like, you know, when you ask about like suicide and stuff, it can show you to help centers, et cetera, mental health links. They serious loads of that stuff, and it's good they've expanded it to.
Probably should have been there before.
Yeah, probably. But at least it's there now, because I'm sure before you said, we have some results on the web for you. And then the first part is the messages like integration, right? So the way that works is that basically, and it's only for if you're, can anyone, I guess it's only if you're a child in family sharing. Is that correct?
Right. That's correct. Yeah.
So if you're a child account in family sharing, your messages app will basically scan using on device, you know, an on device database, any incoming photo. And if it thinks that there is sensitive material in it, it will like blur it out and it will like mark it with a little like warning sign. And you can click on it. And when you tap on it, it will like say, you know, be aware this photo may be sensitive to view. It may include, they have a nice wording of it. Sensitive photos and videos show the private body parts that you cover with bathing suits, which is quite a nice way to sum it up.
Yeah.
And they have some like tips about, you know, don't feel like this is your fault. These images can hurt you. Like just some nice friendly language for, you know, young people that, it's basically like a barrier to stop them from seeing it, right? And if you do want to see, you can say, I'm sure. And then it will also notify the parents on the family sharing account that basically this material the child has opted to see. And it gives you a warning that basically the parents are going to know about this. And you can choose don't view or view. And if you choose view, obviously it reveals the picture. I don't know if you say view, does the parent get to see what it was?
I don't think so.
Because I feel like that
would involve
a feature.
Apple.
I think you could do it end to end, right? Because if you pressed view, it could basically just send an iMessage sending the picture to the parent, you know? Like, it wouldn't actually require Apple having the image. You could do it on the device side.
Yeah, that's true. I don't think they said, though.
Yeah,
we'll have to look into that.
I don't think it says that it does, but I feel like that's kind of an important thing because, like, this system is occasionally going to get it wrong, right? Like,
yeah.
Or even if it is like, you know, and they like it might just be like a naked scene from a movie, you know, like not every picture is, like some of it is unfortunately, but there are occasions where it's going to get it wrong or it's going to be like in a context of something that. And if you just, like, I don't know what the parent sees, right? Like, if you're a 13-year-old and you're like, okay, your friends are just chatting or whatever, and they send you a picture from, you know, an Apple TV Plus show, like that has naked materials in quite a lot of it, right? You could send a screenshot and, you know, you're just talking about the show or whatever, and then you click view photo. Like, what does it say to the parent? Does it say, this person's seeing sexy, or, like, I feel like you almost have to have the image to get right. the context, right? So that would be something that's the
a
one,
good point.
That's the one shortcoming on that, on the messages thing, that I feel like it should at least, even if it doesn't, like, it should at least have an option for when it says view photo, like view photo and send to parent, you know, just to, like, so they can get what's going on,
yeah.
right? Because otherwise, there's going to be a really awkward conversation where it's like, an alert pops up on the parents thing, which is like, you know, your child is looking at sensitive imagery, and then they have to go to the child, and the child might, like, feel embarrassed about it, or they have to, like,
yeah.
you know, oh, mum, I wasn't actually looking at this. Look, please just trust me. You know, like, I feel like it's a bit of a weakness. So, in my opinion, that should at least have an option to send the image on.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
Yeah, but otherwise, I think it's a great idea because it's just a simple, like, firewall, basically, for potentially illicit messages. And unfortunately, you know, you don't need, like iMessage, it runs off your phone number or your email address, right? Like, someone yeah. can very easily get your email address or your phone number and start sending stuff at you. And you can block them, but before you block them, the images are coming in. So at least just having yeah. a little like first step of protection is a nice addition. And that all happens. Because iMessage is end-to-end encrypted, but this is all happening on the device, yes. right? Nothing's getting sent anywhere.
Yep.
And there's no reporting of anything of that, right? Like, it's just nope. all on-device thing. It could happen without that internet connection.
Yeah, it's pretty much purely just a parental control feature.
Mm-hmm.
And then it works the other way, too. So if a child tries to send a picture that is potentially sensitive, you'll see a similar warning, like, are you sure you want to send this?
Right, okay. Got you.
So, it's really just an expansion of the parental controls feature.
Again, this feels almost, like, so obvious. It probably should have been there for a while. You know, mm-hmm. like, if you're just a... And they should expand this to, like, online content, I would argue, as well. Like, at least as an option, like, families could have automatic... Because that you can already, like, enforce the content security filter, right? Mm-hmm. Like, which stops children from going to select websites and stuff. But, you know... People just share images all the time on social networks and all sorts of things. Like, if Apple could just automatically blur that out and require, like, a second step, that'd be good too. But starting with messages, yeah. obviously, it's a great thing to start. So the Siri and Search app is literally the most uncontroversial part in the world. The messages thing, I think everybody's happy with. The thing that's, mm-hmm. like, you know, a bit fiery is the CSAM stuff because...
Yeah.
Apple is essentially, on your device, scanning photos... you know, for illicit content, and if there are enough matches, then you basically get reported to the official body, and then Apple and will send your photo library across, right? And the way it works is the phone, like, holds the database of known, you know, sexually explicit mm-hmm. content, child yes. pornography, etc. And then the phone will, like, watch your photo library, and it'll analyze a series of images. And basically, it, like, starts a counter, right? And Apple doesn't say the mm-hmm. threshold, like, how many it takes.
No.
It's presumably more than one, but, you know, like, yeah. once it flags, like, 10 times or whatever, then the account basically gets sent to Apple for review, and then a human, like, looks at the case, and then it gets sent onwards. Now, I could see why this is somewhat ethically challenging if it applied, like, just to your phone outright.
Mm-hmm.
And if it just, like, you have your phone, and then suddenly now your phone's, like, scanning your entire hard drive, checking it, all of your content, you know, for this stuff. And maybe sometimes it gets it wrong, maybe sometimes it gets it right, regardless, right? Like, if it was just happening to your entire device, like, I think it's fine, but there is definitely, like, somewhat of an ethical situation to be had about it, right? Even if it's all done, like, end-to-end encrypted and everything, there is, like, there's something that needs to be discussed, right? But the way that Apple's announced it today is that it only applies to photos that get uploaded to iCloud Photos, right? So photos right. that were getting sent to Apple servers to be stored never in an end-to-end encrypted form before, right? Like, messages are end-to-end encrypted, but photos are always just stored on Apple servers. They're stored mm-hmm. in an encrypted fashion, but Apple holds the key, so they can always get the photos. Right. And if you are under the subject of... law enforcement or whatever, today, before this comes in, they can go to Apple, subpoena information, and they can get all your uploaded photos off iCloud Photos mm-hmm. already, right? That information is just available, right? Because, you know, if Apple gets a warrant, they turn it over, they're going to get your pictures. So all this is doing is basically taking a scanning process that could and maybe already was happening on the server side, right?
Mm-hmm.
And just bringing it to the device. Like Facebook, Twitter, Google Storage, Google Drive, like all these companies, they have rights. They have, not rights, but like, I'm blanking on the word, but like a civil service or whatever you want to call it, right? To basically look at the content that gets uploaded to them, to whitelist it, blacklist it, act on it. You know, Facebook has hundreds of thousands of people reviewing everything that gets uploaded to Facebook, right? Google Drive analyzes using very similar algorithms, your content. And if there is stuff that is that gets flagged as a criminal or illicit, then it gets passed on to authorities. That's just what happens. And iPhotos, at the end of the day, is just another web service. And so all the only big, like, technical difference between the Apple approach and what every other web service, internet service company does is that it's just doing that scanning on your actual phone versus it happening on a server. So arguably it's more private than the status quo, but it's still basically the status quo, right?
The thing that's, I think, really important to remember too is that it's looking at images on your phone and then checking them against a database of like known CSAM images that's provided by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. So they're just matching the pictures. And if there's a certain number of matches, then Apple gets an alert. They manually review to make sure the hashes of the images match properly. Then it goes to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. So they say like the likelihood of a false positive is, what is it? Like one in one trillion.
Yeah,
per year. So they're pretty confident that you're not going to get false positives with this setup. Like, it's not like, if you're not doing anything bad, you don't have anything to worry about.
And it's not like, at a high level, it sounds the same as like object recognition, right? In photos.
Right, which is
where it's
not
like finding
what it
mountains
is.
Or trees and stuff. But it's not like, the way it works is it's not like looking for body parts, right? It's not looking at your photo library and going, oh, this person looks young. Oh, you know, they are exposed or whatever. Let's flag it. It's literally looking for exact matches to images that have already been reported as being explicit content, right? Whereas like finding pictures of mountains, it's, you know, it's doing analysis and it's like, this thing looks like a mountain. It's not like going, oh, this looks like this exact mountain that we have in this database. Like, so I know on Twitter, some people are saying like, well, what if I'm a parent, I've got pictures of my kids, they're in the bath, you know, they're doing this. I don't want to get inadvertently flagged, even if Apple's going to review it and realize it's fine. Like that feels like an invasion of privacy. But that's not what's going on here, because the hashing is literally looking for already reported, you know, criminal content, right? Like, and unfortunately, the sad reality is probably like a huge percentage of overall, you know, CSAM content, it's the same like set of 20,000 pictures on repeat, right? Shared around the dark web and wherever else, however it gets shared around, right? Like, there's just so, like, I watched a documentary on this like last year, and it was, I think it was from the perspective of the police, and it was people who basically, they were investigating alleged, you know, child exploiters, basically. And they would just like say, I've literally seen this same picture, this like 2-year-old, like 20 times before. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not like, like obviously content's getting generated all the time, but with a database of, you know, 20,000 of the most common pictures, you can probably weed out so much like criminal behavior just with that very like naive system. You don't have to have like complicated like detections for how old is this person? Who is this person? Like, if you're just matching against known popular images, that's like a huge sieve that'll have like wide reaching impact, right?
Mm-hmm. That's exactly it.
Yeah. And the other important thing here is that it only applies to photos uploaded to iCloud. It doesn't apply to iCloud backup. And I do think that's an important point, because like iCloud photos, if you don't like the policy, you don't have to use it, right? You can turn off iCloud photos. Mm-hmm. You can go and you can back up manually with a computer. You can copy your photos off, or you can use any third party service that will back up your photos as well. They have pretty good integration with the Photos SDK. It's fine. I mean, all the other web services will do exactly this policy too, but you at least have you have your choice, right? Like, it's your device, you get to choose. iCloud backup, if the policy like applied to all photos that were getting backed up, I think, again, there'd be more of an argument about it, right? Because iCloud backup is kind of, irreplaceable. Like, no other company apart from Apple has enough access to the system to actually offer an iCloud backup equivalent, right? Like, you can either back up through iTunes or you can back up with iCloud backup. Like, you can't really have another, like, Google can't really come along and be like, we can back up your entire phone for you, right? Press this button and we'll automatically back up your phone on a weekly basis. Like, iOS, the security model just doesn't really allow that to happen. So iCloud backup is basically the only option. And if you were forced into, like, opting to this policy with iCloud backup, I could again see a bit of a room for a, you know, at least a debate, right? Like, but as it stands today, and, you know, fair enough, maybe in the future, Apple will expand its technology to other parts of the phone. And if it does, we can, you know, rediscuss it. But as it stands today, only applying to photos that are getting uploaded to iCloud Photos, it really feels like a mountain over a molehill for people to get mad about it, because it is no different to any other online service that hosts user-generated content.
Yep.
And I very much welcome it. I think it's a great idea.
No, I think it's definitely something that needed to be there a while ago, again, because you look at all the other services and they're already doing it. So I guess what Apple was waiting on was coming up with this way to make it even more secure than what Google and Facebook are doing by doing it all on device. So it took longer than the competitors, but hopefully, despite what you might see on Twitter, it's even more privacy friendly.
Yeah, and government, and like, I will say that there are like governments and stuff who've basically been campaigning for this technology to get rolled out to like WhatsApp and private communication stuff, and like clearly iMessage would be a target. Because, you know, they're basically using similar-ish technology for the first feature, right? But the whole reporting side gives it a bit more of a, like a, I don't want to say sinister angle, but more serious, or like, you know, it has consequence at that point, right? And if you're having like private end-to-end communication, even if the scanning's happening on device and it's not like breaking end-to-end encryption, then you're having more of a, like, you're entering more of a gray area about what's acceptable or not, right? But, and maybe governments will now be like, right, Apple, we want you to do this for messages too, and we'll see how they respond to that, right? I still would welcome it in messages, but I can understand there are people out there who would be freaked out by that, and I can at least, you know, reason with them at some level. Getting annoyed over this, what they've announced today about photos getting uploaded to iCloud Photos, that's just ridiculous. If you think this is a stupid, like, don't use iCloud Photos if you don't want to, right?
Yeah. And the government concerns could be why, for right now, it's US only. So it'll be something to watch whether and which countries they try to bring it to in the future.
And these, all of these features roll out as part of updates later this year, right? Is that correct? Yeah.
Not necessarily in iOS 15. They say an update to iOS 15. So probably like 15.1, 15.2.
Yeah. Okay, well, great. I mean, especially like, you know, the CSAM stuff doesn't affect me that's just the reality of it. But like the messages feature, like, you know, I have a sister. She has learning disabilities. I like it that that's there. Like, you know, she can't read a lot of words, right? She could just randomly talk to a stranger and they could send her stuff and she wouldn't have to deal with it. So just having these safeguards in place. Like, I'm not going to use an alternative messaging app that would just have these features. I want to use iMessage, right? And so Apple just has to build more and more of this stuff into the system because it is critically important, especially for, you know, kids and stuff. So that would, like, directly benefit me for sure. Finally this week, Happy Hour is brought to you by Text Expander. Thanks to our friends at Smart Software for sponsoring the show. Supercharge you and your team with the power of Text Expander. Text Expander lets you do more with the same human resources. You have less repetition, fewer errors, and greater consistency. Use Text Expander to turn the things you type into reusable snippets that can be used again and again and again. Say goodbye to repetitive text entry, spelling errors, and even trying to remember the right thing to say. Save time and be consistent while you're at it. You can speed through email, just type a short abbreviation that expands into a reusable form with fill-in-the-blank fields to customize the reply as appropriate for the current message. It's so much better than copy and paste. Text Expander snippets let you maximize your time by getting rid of the repetitive things that you type while still allowing the customization and personalization of your messages. Text Expander makes it easy to give your team the right words for every situation. Whether you need to keep legal happy or just delight customers with answers that you know are effective, you can rest easy in the knowledge that your team has got it covered with a centralized database of Text Expander snippets. With Text Expander, you keep your team accurate and current with all the changes and latest messaging for your business and brand. And of course, it's just as useful as an individual. Just create a powerful snippet once, and then you can use the assigned abbreviation to let TextExpander do the rest of the work for you, eliminate spelling mistakes, and speed up everything that you do. TextExpander works on any platform, in any app, anywhere that you can type. Take back your time and unlock your productivity with TextExpander. Listeners to this show can get 20% off their first year subscription. Visit textexpander.com/podcast to learn more and sign up. That's textexpander.com/podcast. Okay, a few more stories before we wrap up this week. Firstly, there was a rumor about the titanium iPhone 14. So, obviously, the iPhone 13 is coming out within, what, like a month? I mean, September or whatever, it's come up on us fast. And it's basically going to look like the same as the iPhone 12. Bigger cameras, as we mentioned earlier. 120Hz refresh rate screens, a ProMotion display. I'm very excited about that. But the general industrial design is going to look like the iPhone 12. For the iPhone 14 next year, we're expecting, again, a more of a design change, right? And there was a report from analysts at JP Morgan Chase that Apple's going to launch a significant specification upgrade next year. So the quote-unquote iPhone 14 in 2022. And the body of the high-end models will be made of a titanium alloy. So right now, the iPhones are what? They're stainless steel frames and glass back and front.
Stainless steel.
Yeah, stainless steel surround and then glass back and front. And the cheaper iPhone, the mini and iPhone 12, they're aluminium sides, right? So with the iPhone 14, Apple will be changing from stainless steel to titanium. And then I think the reports seem to suggest that some other like lower-end models would move to stainless steel, right? So it wouldn't be just like the two high-end pros would go to titanium. Stainless steel would like move down the line a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, without knowing the design of the iPhone 14, like it's like, well, what is the story? But like, I think it's going to be a bit material shakeup, right? Because like they've done titanium in the Apple Watch, but the iPhone's been like glass and stainless steel for quite a few years at this point.
And when you look at the iPhone 12 Pro, one of the complaints is that it's heavy. So titanium should make it lighter, at least if you compare, like the Apple Watch titanium is lighter than the stainless steel Apple Watch. So hopefully that means maybe the iPhone 14 Pro will be lighter than the iPhone 13 Pro and 12 Pro.
Yeah, that'd be quite nice, to be honest. Like, they are a bit heavy. Like, I think the overall industrial design of the current phones and, like, basically, like, the iPhone 10 era phones is clearly superior to, like, the old stuff. But if you pick up an iPhone 6, like, the thinness, slenderness, and the weight is, like, strikingly impressive. Like, could you just get used to something? Because, like, the iPhone 6 is, like, the time when the iPhone was, like, the lightest, and it was the thinnest, right? So, I think the iPhone 5 was, like, the thinnest, the lightest iPhone ever. But the iPhone 6 is, like, the lightest for the screen size, because obviously the screen got substantially bigger that generation. Yeah. But also, it was, like, super thin. Like, nowadays, so thin, the iPhone is, like, 8mm, 9mm. Yeah, the iPhone 6 would bend, so that, I guess, was a knock against it. But if you just look at it, like, it still looks thinner than the current phones, right? And it would be nice to get some of that back. You know, even if the thickness is staying as it is, and I think it probably is because of the camera systems, getting some of the weight back would be nice. Because you pick up, like, the big iPhone 12 Pro Max, you know,
it's big,
it's heavy. It's big and it's heavy, and a lot of that is the glass and the battery, right? But some of that's definitely the sides as well. So if they can make the sides lighter, at least it'd have a little bit of a impact. And then we got a new Mac Pro this week. Well, not quite,
sort of.
they basically upgraded the graphics on the Mac Pro, so now you can get build to order options with a W6800X, a W6800X Duo, and a W6900X. The prices are pretty inflated. It's up to like $6,000, but they are the workstation GPUs. So the workstation model of the AMD graphics card, they're more expensive than like consumer versions. So like I think the $5,600 6900, which is what Apple sells for, you know, almost $6,000. That retails the workstation version for like $4,000, I think, in other places. And the Apple version isn't exactly the same because you get a bit more RAM and it's in the MPX module shape, which obviously fits the Mac Pro. But beyond like the specifics, it's just nice that the Intel Mac Pro has actually seen an update, right? Because when they released this thing in 2019, it was meant to be a break away from the failings of the 2013 trash can Mac Pro, mm-hmm. which couldn't be updated. You know, it got stuck in a thermal corner. It basically had the same processor and graphics cards for its entire lifetime. So when they came out with this thing, they were like actively saying this is a modular machine. You know, we expect it to be around for a long time. It's continuously upgradable. And yeah, you can put any graphics card that you can buy and that has drivers for it inside that case, but it's a lot nicer when they're using the MPX module shape and they fit the design and they have the, you know, the direct slots and they have the Thunderbolt ports at the back. Like, so the fact that Apple's supporting it with these graphics card options is nice to see. Also, I think it kind of speaks to the longevity of this machine because, like, mm-hmm. obviously, when they did it in 2019, they knew the ARM transition was happening, right? And so when they built it, that was part of the discussion. Arguably, they could have just not done the Mac Pro and just waited out for the ARM thing, but they chose to do it, right? And mm-hmm. I think the reality is there is going to be an ARM Mac Pro, you know, probably next year, but this Intel version, it's going to be on sale for a while, right? Like, we've got rumors of the processor upgrade, so it's going mm-hmm. to get, like, Ice Lake Xeon chips next year as well. And maybe that'll be its, like, last chip upgrade, but I don't think it's going to go away. Like, if you look, I think the Mac Minis, right? So right now, you get the M1 Mac Mini, and then you get the Intel Mac Minis at the higher level. They're obviously going to get replaced with M1 at the low end, and then, like, M1X or whatever at the higher end mm-hmm. of that, you know, new design Mac Mini Pro thing that we've seen floating around. But the Mac Pro, there are all the rumors about the half size one, and I'm sure that's going to come out, and I'm sure it's going to be really fast. It'll probably be faster than the Intel Mac Pro, at least in CPU. Maybe it can't match the GPUs because it's going to, like, for an integrated graphics system, it's going to be hard to match, like, the maximum top end of what the Intel Mac Pro can offer, right? Because the Intel Mac Pro, you know, we just spoke about those graphics card options. You can have four of them in a Mac Pro, you know, like, you can have four $6,000 graphics cards in that case if you want to and use them all concurrently. I think it's going to be hard for Apple Silicon to match, like, the very, very top end of what the Intel Mac Pro can offer computationally, mm-hmm. At least on the graphics side. So that might be an option to keep it around. And I think the more like practical thing is that the ARM Mac Pro is just going to be less upgradable, less expandable, right? And for all the companies out there that are buying the Mac Pro today, a lot of them are buying it for the expandability, for the usage, you know, for the flexibility that it provides. They're not just buying it because it's like the fastest CPU option for multi-core, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's part of the equation, but a lot of it's just the fact that it's expandable and you can put different slots in. And maybe even the ARM Mac Pro, it's half size. Maybe it still has like one slot for upgradability, but it's not going to have like the rack of six that the current Intel Mac Pro has. So whereas like the rest of the lineups, it's going to go ARM only. I think we could easily see like this Intel Mac Pro design continue to be sold as a high-end option. Not as like the primary options, like developers and stuff would obviously be well best served by the ARM version that's coming out next year. Mm-hmm. But for like, you know, high-end workstation solutions, video processing shops, that kind of thing, they're just going to keep selling this Intel Mac Pro with, you know, infrequently updated graphics and CPU options, probably for like another half a decade. Like, they're going to get, they designed it in 2019. I think they're going to want to get their run of this chassis. Like, I don't think it's going to disappear. And I bet the ARM Mac Pro, the half size one, I bet it like shares a lot of the same design. Like, I don't think they're going to have something radically different. It will just be like a smaller version of what the Intel Mac Pro is. I don't know if you have any disagreement.
No, I mean, the thing partially too, like in our little bubble, it's easy to say like so many apps are already optimized for Apple Silicon, mm-hmm. but probably for some people who are buying the high end Intel Mac Pro, that's not necessarily the case yet. So you can't,
and they probably
want to
like
have
really
one
specific
Intel
accessories, specific drivers, you know, mm-hmm. Maybe they even need like root access to do crazy specific stuff that they're not going to accommodate for. And when Apple said they were making this design in 2019 to be like, you know, long term, part of it is the Intel compatibility story, right? Basically just carry on selling Mac Pro for a long time. But also, I think they probably like had at least one eye to the fact that it was going to get swapped out with an ARM core at some point, right?
Yeah.
And so they take the current Mac Pro, they slice it in half because you don't need as much thermal headroom, but you still have like all the investment you put into designing that chassis. You can basically reuse it. It's just half the height, right? And you just have less slots. Mm-hmm. Probably the same ports on the back, but just internal upgradeability will be a lot lower, and you can get your investment returns on that machine.
Mm-hmm.
Along that basis, just to round out this week, Mark Gurman had a report basically in his newsletter. There was a question about whether Apple will meet its goal for the two-year transition. And Gurman basically said Apple will barely hit it. So he's basically implying that maybe the iMac Pro or the 27-inch iMac Pro replacement thing, those Apple Silicon machines, they'll come out within the 2 years, but don't expect them like, you know, March or June or whatever. It's going to be like down to the wire, like full 2022 is when you can expect the transition to fully complete. Like in my head, I was thinking the 2 year timeframe was up in the summer next year.
Yeah.
But that's when they announced they were doing ARM, whereas Gurman times it based on when they released the first laptop, which was obviously in the fall of last year. So if you go full 2020, it ends in 2022. If you go from the WWDC announcement of the transition to Apple Silicon, which is when they first mentioned the two-year time frame, then it would end in like the summer of next year. But I think Mark's right, and that you probably have to time it from when the first one came out. And when they did the PowerPC to Intel transition, they like beat their time frame like quite handily. Mm-hmm. Like they said it was like going to be like a 2 year transition then, and they did them all in like, including the Mac Pro at the time, within like 13 months of like the WWDC when they announced the switch to Intel. It seems here they're not going to be quite so expedient. Like they obviously did the core machines like way soon, like the 13-inch MacBook Pro and the MacBook Air. Like that's Apple's. That's what probably like 75% of Apple's Mac volume is just those two products. And so they had them like right out the gate. And now they've added the 24-inch iMac. And then, you know, I believe within 2 or 3 months, we've got M1X MacBook Pros on the way. So that'll cover like, you know, most of the spectrum. And then at the very high end, you've got the 27-inch iMac replacement and obviously the iMac Pro. So we've already heard about rumors that don't expect the 27-inch model to come out, you know, at minimum be like summer of next year. So
yeah,
it's the Mac Pro and the high end like iMac are going to be the stragglers, but they'll barely be there by next year.
And it could have been that Apple had a more aggressive timeline, but I think as we've seen, they've had enough trouble keeping things in stock and everything as is. So it's probably pretty likely that some stuff just got pushed. Like it's just been the past year has been a lot different than the PowerPC transition was.
Yeah. Like that was like perfect world conditions, right?
Yeah.
Was there. And here we've got the pandemic, which is obviously slowing hardware development down. And you've got the chip shortages, which is reducing availability of components. So like,
and if you look at it from Apple's perspective too, they're not going to take production away from the MacBook Air or the MacBook Pro to fund the high end iMac or the Mac Pro. Like,
yeah, and even
they
like
just got to keep up.
Even the iPhone and the iPad, right? Like, they're having chip shortages, and not just like it's not just like a chip shortage. It's also all the factories are like full capacity, right? So they're obviously going to prioritize the iPhone and the iPad, and then you know MacBook Air that's like the second tier. Even if Apple like missed the 2 year timeline on the ARM Mac Pro, you know, it's not really going to shake the house down. Like, people aren't going to be like raving in the streets. If like the 16-inch MacBook Pro was delayed by that long, then that'd be more significant. But even like the 27-inch iMac, like people who are buying that, most like they're such a small niche. Like the Mac Pro and the 27-inch iMac Pro, that's probably what like 5, maybe 10% max of the entire Mac sales. Like, it's so dominated by MacBook Air, 13-inch MacBook Pro, and then obviously probably like another 20% slices the higher end MacBook Pros, but I just want the MacBook Pro to come out.
Maybe a couple months or maybe not.
Yeah. I'm so ready for it. Like it's been quite warm here recently. We've had a bit of like a heat wave in the UK. And
this
thing, the fans got like basically as soon as the outdoor temperature goes above like 24 degrees Celsius, the fans just go to like full blast, and I look at this temperature monitor the CPU is running at like 90 degrees. I'm barely even doing anything. Like I'm like scrolling Twitter and it's like 90 degree temperature. The fans are full blast. I think it's a combination of the heat and the fact that this machine is now like 5 years old. It's probably built out with like dust and stuff. And like, I'm sure the fans are all gummed up with dust and it's just all of that stuff combined. It's basically, let me put it this way. Every time I sit down and use the computer, it's like, why can't it be M1X MacBook Pro all today? But I don't want to buy anything else now, you know? Like, I've come this far. It's like the marathon. I'm probably the only tech journalist still using a Butterfly Keyboard Mac Pro with the Butterfly keyboard never repaired. So that's like my saving grace, is I can at least be like the only one suffering, but it is a suffering.
I don't know if that's something to be proud of.
Yeah. I need to, when I order the new one, I don't know, I need to do like a victory lap celebration, some video on Twitter of like the fans are one thing, the keyboard, you can literally pick up the laptop and keys fall out. Like it's literally a
nice.
So I'm so ready. We still got, you know, it's probably going to be October when it's announced, right? Like, that's most likely. So,
what are you thinking? You think September event for the iPhone, then another Apple Silicon event in October, November?
Yeah, I think so. Maybe they do iPhone, Apple Watch September, and then the second round of Mac stuff. And then maybe like the other iPads, right? Like, there's going to be the iPad mini update,
iPad mini.
And then a processor. There's supposed to be an update to the cheap iPad as well. So, I think that's what's going to happen. They'll probably do September for that stuff and then the Macs follow in October. Unfortunately, I'd rather it all happen in September, but when Apple's clearly, they're all going to be video events, right? At least through the end of this year. So yeah. Apple's got no need to like pack the events into 2 hour shows. They can just do, you know. If I had to completely guess, I reckon we won't have three events this fall. We'll just have two.
Because the iPhones will be September.
And like, they probably last year, if it wasn't for the delays, they probably would have done the same thing, right? They'd have one event for the Mac stuff, and then they'd then watch iPad and iPhone together in September. So this year, it seems like production-wise, the iPhone's on track. So we're probably just going to have two events, hopefully September, October. And, you know, I prefer September, October to September, November. Let me put it that way.
Yeah.
But still a couple of months, and then I will be over the moon with the M1X MacBook Pro. Like, can't wait. All right. Thank you, Chance, for joining us this week.
Of course. I'm happy to be here.
On Happy Hour. If people want to find you, tell them the Twitter, the web, whatever you want.
You can follow me on Twitter. I am at Chance H. Miller. And subscribe to 9 to 5 Mac Daily. It's 5 days a week of Apple news in 5 to 10 minutes. It's pretty fun.
Yeah, it's great. It's a great podcast. And of course, this podcast is great as well. Thank you to everybody that subscribes in Apple Podcasts. If you love the show, regardless of whether you subscribe or not, we love you too. You can contact us at happyhour@95mac.com. I'm at BZMA on Twitter. And if you want to subscribe, you can do that on Apple Podcasts. It's $4.99 a month or $50 a year. And if you don't want to subscribe, that's perfectly fine too. Just leave us like a 5-star rating in iTunes or something. We appreciate it all. Thank you very much. Thank you, Chance, for being this week, and we'll be back with another Happy Hour next week. Bye-bye.